From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them.
The great thing that I really liked, and I'd do it again, is really be in charge of everything, from finding the property to setting up the IT system to doing the bookkeeping with yourself and so on and so forth.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Xavier Vidal, owner of the Irish master franchise for Amarino Gelato. If you're unfamiliar with Amarino, it started in 2002 as a single ice cream shop in France and has since expanded internationally with hundreds of locations around Europe, the Middle East and America. In this interview, Xavier talks about his time as a corporate CEO, what he learned from studying at the Harvard Business School and why he left the executive boardroom to pursue his own business. Xavier has a wealth of experience in retail, so it's worth listening towards the end of our conversation when he talks about what it takes to build a successful retail business. I started out by asking Xavier about the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and how he sees the next few months unfolding for the retail industry here in Ireland.
Well, I think the first stage will be about, you know, reopening, which we all are starting to do. Take back all the good habits and hopefully leaving the bad habits behind and start to have customer back with us and get them to come back and come back again. Obviously, in Dublin, and for most European countries and worldwide countries, the type of customer is going to be a bit changed, simply because the tourist will be not there at first anyway, which means that depending on which categories or what kind of segment you're in or which location you're in, you'll have an impact to your sales. So that's the first stage. After that, because a lot of businesses have had to take on their own cash in order to pay for some fixed costs, and for a lot of other businesses, sales that have been lost is lost forever. For others, they may be able to catch up, electrician, things like that. In retail, I think a fair amount of, you know, Mother's Day and the flowers, if it's past, it's past, you've missed it. So I think the second stage would be about cash flows and the business that will be able to see a full year, which would be in French, I don't know if you call it that way, but it's called a white year where you got nothing. And therefore, the second stage would be about which one can survive. And then after that, it will be growth again, I hope. So,
yeah, like, talk to me about that, because there's a general kind of consensus that retail is in decline with online and e-commerce and everything else. Where do you see that going? Is this compounding that trend? Is that a myth, or is it only certain retail outlets?
No, it's not a myth. you can see it, and myself, I've never ordered so many things on Amazon over the last 3 months. It all depends on categories. If you take ice cream, yeah, you know, you've got Ben & Jerry's, they're going to try to have drone deliveries. But I do think that customers do like the experience. They like, not everybody has a nice home. Going out, seeing friends is important. Going around, seeing a different sceneries remain important. So I think from an overall retail, I think if there is the depression and, you know, that time is tough, people would spend a bit less. And again, it would depend by category. In some places, they spend a bit more. Mm-hmm. But there'll be less players. And that will be then a matter of those players getting maybe a bigger slice of that smaller pie. If you've got a good brand and you know how to handle your cash and you know where to spend the money and you've got enough cash to look at a 5 years horizon, I think retail is alive. It's just that the traffics have changed quite dramatically, and we need to work better with landlords, and government needs to work better with landlords and retailers in order to find the right balance.
So the high street isn't exactly going away, it's just changing.
It's absolutely. I think everybody wants a nice high street. Actually, you know, when you, but a high street in South County Dublin, in Bray, or actually Bray is Wicklow, in Dunleary, I think everybody likes his high streets. The only problem, I think there's a duty for retailers, landlords and government to find the balance so that everybody makes money. Mm-hmm. At this point in time, landlords have been making too much money, in my view. Retailers, not enough. Mm-hmm. and government's been milking on that and other things. So I think it's just finding the right balance between those three players so that we can have a vibrant high street.
How did you first get involved in retail?
I was 16. I wanted to own my own car. So I worked in behind the till, and I thought it was an interesting job with people interactions and customers and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So. And after that, I mean, you stayed, you obviously went and studied and did everything else and then remained in retail. What was your first corporate retail job, let's call it?
Well, interestingly enough, I wanted to be a fish farmer. So retail was just a way of making money. But when I realized that fish farming was going to be not as exotic as I would have liked it to be, I focused on retail to make money. So my first corporate job was really, thanks to all the experience I gathered during my studies, I was able to be a buyer in the equivalent. It's called Auchan. It's the equivalent of Tesco in France. Mm-hmm. So I got a buying role there, and then made my way up from there.
And was that directly after college? Or
yeah.
Did you,
yeah.
And fish farming, where did that?
I was living in Paris, and I've always liked the sea, but I was not seeing it enough. And I liked the idea of scuba diving and animals. So, yeah, I thought that could help in terms of environment. And even at that stage, I think I had the feeling that we shouldn't have those big nets dragging around and just destroying everything, and that the fish farming was quite a neat thing to do. As it turns out, it's not as neat as it could be, and there's pollution and all that kind of stuff, but it may be a solution.
So you joined the Tesco equivalent in France, and how long did you stay there?
Not long, because I had met my wife, who is Irish, and I moved to, so I've stayed a year, and then I got a job in Tesco in Dublin.
Right.
To be with my wife and not commute all the time.
And how long did you stay with Tesco?
Stay with Tesco 5 years, a year and a half, 2 years here in Dublin, and they asked me in the UK.
You have a very good grasp of finance and accounting, and a kind of a good grasp of the whole business in general. Was it in Tesco where you learned all this, that kind of got the basis for everything, or was that later on, or as you progressed?
I think what Tesco and my earlier job taught me is understanding the customers and go from production to the shelves. In Tesco, you were always encouraged to, you know, a day a week to go into stores, that as a buyer you would go and understanding the manufacturing side and try to understand the process. Initially, I was buying alcohol, and I guess it gave me a good understanding on the whole supply chain to bringing that product into the customer hand, but that it was starting somewhere, or from a farm or from a factory standpoint, whatever.
So it was merchandising and that kind of thing learning that side of the business, really?
For me, merchandising is putting it on shelves. But if you look at the whole supply chain and the buying and the volume and the forecast, it comes down to understand how much you can sell to that customers and how much do they need it and when do they need it. Turkey, for example, is a very interesting product, because you grow that turkey, you want to make it fat, but you want to make it fat just in time at Christmas. Mm-hmm. And in America, it's Thanksgiving. So, you know, that whole process. And you also want to make money when you sell it. But sometimes it's more about price perception, so you may not make money. So again, it's getting the mix right from that. So in Tesco, that's really what I've learned is the whole importance of looking at from start to finish and how to commercially drive as much volume as you can on the range of products.
Was it easy learning the business? Was it like, you obviously, you're very knowledgeable now about retail and how everything works and so on, but at the time, was it a curiosity that drove you, or was it people you worked with?
I think it's a mix of things. I was lucky to, you know, Tesco at the time was seen as the best retailer in the world. And that was driven by, you know, Terry Leahy. And I remember I had the opportunity to sit down with him and discuss about tea. I was a tea buyer, and I had been a tea buyer for 6 months. He knew much more than me on tea. And he went on a tangent on Earl Grey and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh my God, I don't know anything. So I think it's one of the things you... Yeah, I think it gave me a good foundation, Tesco, and where I was able to learn, to challenge, and there was a good set of people. You know, I'll give you the example of Terry Leahy, but there was many more people that gave me more time than he has, because I had half an hour of it. And yeah, there was a whole culture, which was about work hard, play hard, and challenging to focus on customers all the time. And that give you a good grand on things. And you know.
And where did you go from after 5 years in Tesco?
Well, Sainsbury's knocked on my door. And what was kind of interesting is that I wanted to do more in Tesco. And Sainsbury's was in the press saying they were going to collapse. They had a new management team. Cash was running out, whatever. But then that new management team wanted some Tesco blood. So I came in on, and it was great because, well, I was still very young, the Sainsbury's new management team, so that was Justin King, Mike Cook, whatever, were coming from Asda, so Archie Norman leadership, which was all about taking young people and getting them to learn a lot and putting them at a fairly high position quickly to give them a chance. And that was a great culture. So, you know, I was given a task. So at the time, it was frozen food. I was category manager of frozen food, which was, I can't remember, but it may have been 200 million business. But it was a bit in disarray, and they said, sort it out. And the team was not working very well. The previous manager was a very nice person, but I'm going to say end of life type of thing, so yeah. He couldn't care less. The opportunity was there for Sainsbury's to give a much better offer to frozen food, to the customers. So I did a good job and they promoted me within 9 months. And there was a very clear, you know, do this, show us you can do that, deliver numbers, make sure your people are, talking positively about you. And then we'll get you to the next step, which at the next step was, I think I was 30 or 31. And I then was in charge of, I think it was £4 or 5 billion, which was huge at that age. But that was the desire of the management to drive people. And it was also due to the fact that I had petrol, which makes a huge... But Sainsbury's was the number one petrol retailer in the UK. And then I had all the bad stuff for you, which included all the categories I had bought before, from biscuits, confectionery, to alcohol, Christmas, and some things.
Were you confident enough in what you had learned in Tesco that you could do what they wanted you to do at that point?
Yeah, what was interesting is that, so basically I was what they called at the time category manager. So I honed the category frozen food, and I would have had to work with the retail team and the property team to overhaul our frozen food offer. All things that I had kind of more or less learned in Tesco, but not necessarily at that level, not as a total category. I had been a category manager, but it would have been biscuits and confectionery. You wouldn't have had the supply chain complexity of frozen food. So I think, yeah, I've always been a fairly confident person, maybe too confident at times. And certainly for me, I was like, well, that job is too small for me. That was my... Now, I've learned the hard way that sometimes, you know, I was too confident, but certainly I did a good job there, obviously, because otherwise they wouldn't have promoted me, and I didn't doubt a minute. I actually thought they were not giving me enough. So, but it was, it was just fairly confident. From
Sainsbury's, at one stage, sent you to Harvard?
Yep. Yeah, so basically the next stage was to be what they call the business unit director. So I was reporting to the board, to the trading director of the board. The plan was that part of the, you know, the kind of 5 to 10 years plan, I would go and do that management program that was kind of part of the deal to, you know, you do an education and then we'll bring you in a 5 to 10 years to have succession planning. So it was... you know, great opportunity. I had done at the time, so I was in my year 4 of Sainsbury's, and they said, "Look, you go for 2 months and you come back, and we'll see how it goes." So, you know, I had done a good job at the second job in Sainsbury's, and they sent me there, and it was fantastic.
What was the course content like? Was it helpful?
Yeah, I mean, it basically, my background was very commercial, and I studied biology, agriculture, all that kind of stuff, and marketing in a master, marketing and product management. So I didn't have much finance, accounting background. I would know how to talk with the finance controller for the category and looking at a P&L, but I wouldn't have a good grasp on all that. I wouldn't have been trained or whatever. So the good thing about the AMP, which is Advanced Management Program, is that they're giving you an overall picture.
Was it hard to learn?
Yeah, I think it's just the intensity of it. Over 2 months, you know, I remember like they're sending you 12 books or whatever when you have to read them all. And my wife just gave birth. I arrived there. I didn't read any.
Yeah.
So it was a fairly intense course. If I was doing it again, I would do it better. Mm-hmm. I would read the book. but it was hard. But I think the great thing about going back to study once you've actually worked is that you can apply the theory to real life. Mm-hmm. And until then, I didn't really you sit on in a lecture and then you're like, what the hell? Why do I need this? But then so at the time I would have worked like 7 or 8 years, 9 years. And so it was a great opportunity to say, oh, well, I understand now. So I come back and it's funny because when you do that program, that they always tell you that statistically speaking, 3 things happen when you come back. So one is that you divorce, and the third are divorcing. So the good news is that I didn't divorce. The other one is that you get a big pay rise, which didn't happen, or you change job. And when I came back, I told Sainsbury as well, when am I going to the board? And that was not the plan. So we parted the way. Mm-hmm. I think it was within a year of me coming back. Mm-hmm. And I think they were right in saying I was not ready. Mm-hmm. But as far as I was concerned, all my metrics were positive. I was a god. And I was coming back from Harvard, so why did you spend $100,000 not to promote me mm-hmm. to the board? It doesn't work that way in big corporation, and I didn't accept it. So that's why I left, and then I went to the body shop.
And did you get a better job in the body shop? Did you get
it? Yeah, I got a better job, but it's... So I got to the body shop, and it was, in terms of turnover, it was a smaller business. Mm-hmm. So I was in charge of, as I said, let's call it £5 billion. And I went to a business where I was the commercial director for £1 billion business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from a turnover, which I don't believe, for turnover, it was like, why are you doing this? But actually, the great opportunity is that it was a truly international business. It was in 62 countries. I had a smaller team, but, you know, more diverse team. At the time, I was in charge of any kind of range, pricing, retail academy, which was how to train staff, all the channels. So we built the e-commerce plans, franchise model and all that. So it was a much more diverse, interesting job. And from an international standpoint, it was just amazing.
Without putting words in your mouth, I'd say the difference is, like, you're dealing in Sainsbury's with obviously large supermarkets, and then you're kind of going to much smaller and much more niche products as well.
Oh, yeah.
Did kind of property and leases and stuff become an issue at that stage more so than they had been?
Yeah, I wouldn't have had much contact whatsoever with property lease in Tesco or Sainsbury's because you have a whole team dealing with that, right? Mm-hmm. And when I came to the body shop, we had 2,500 stores making $1 billion. And at the end of the day, we had to understand the whole P&L, which was super interesting for me. And obviously within the P&L, you know, once you pay for the rent rates and then once you pay for your staff, then it's your cost of goods. And working in the beauty industry, which was completely new, and my wife would tell you I have no idea about women, so it was kind of an interesting an interesting thing. It enabled me to learn a huge amount, but certainly property and dynamic and location was a big thing in the body shop.
How long did you stay?
I stayed 5 years. First, I did the commercial director, and then I moved to be the managing director of Europe, Middle East, and Africa. So that was more strategy, you know, working alongside the brand team and the operation team, so the three managing directors that were splitting the world in order to deliver the results. Managing director was much more like, okay, let's get the result done. So which was super interesting. And that's where, you know, like I was spending a day a week, if you even in London, and the rest somewhere else.
Was Tiger your next move?
Yeah, Tiger was the next move. Basically, what made me move is don't ever work for a French company. And I can say that. L'Oréal is an amazing business, but it's they have their own management style, which is very French. And I think it's a great business when you're young and you want to learn. After that, it can be a bit frustrating when you're in management. It's very political, and it's very much about, in my view, from where I was sitting, and I could be wrong because L'Oréal is a huge corporate. It was very much about, it was very much about individuals' success more than the brand success. Mm-hmm. And to me, as a retailer, it's all about product and people, or people and products, whatever you want to do. And certainly the way L'Oréal, in my view, were managing people was wrong. However, they're doing an amazing job on products. If you're based in Paris and you've done the right business school and all that kind of stuff, you may have a great time there. For me, it's much more about you get things done, you do them properly, you look after your people, and then the rest follow.
But, and you tell the truth when someone more senior comes by so they can improve the business rather than...
Exactly. Yeah. You don't put lipstick on a pig. So often it happens.
Yes.
You put lipstick on a pig because the big chief is coming.
Yeah.
That's not my style.
So you moved to Tiger then. Did you go looking for Tiger, or did they come looking for you?
No, I was lucky there. They came looking for me, and if at the time you had asked me what I wanted to do next, I would absolutely told you Tiger would be a brand that I really liked. And the main reason was there, and still today, they have an amazing shopping experience, which is, it's hard to find elsewhere in terms of the what people say. So they came, and I had planned to move back to, my family had moved to Ireland 5 years before that. So my plan was to move back to Dublin and do something in Dublin. But then when they come, I had a chat with my wife and I said, well, it's probably my dream job. So so we've agreed that I will commute again.
So it was the CEO of Tiger,
yeah.
Based where?
Copenhagen.
Okay. And the Tiger model is, if I understand it, they do... it's like a franchise model, or they do joint ventures with the various countries?
So they just do joint venture. So there's no franchise model. And that's, again, that was quite interesting because it's not exactly franchise because you own the company. So it's not about sharing the pie and dividing it. It's like owning the pie together and divide the profit, which is a very interesting model for growth. So it's a fantastic model.
Is it a better model than franchising, in your opinion?
I think each category and each country and each moment in time may have a different need. But certainly what I found in the joint venture and the way it was designed is that it's very Danish. So it's very, you're looking at each other in the eyes at the same level. And it's really a 50-50. The only things where it's not a 50-50, it's in the way you agree to buy back the 50%. In order to get the biggest multiple for the partner, the group needs to take the decision. And then you get a better multiple than if the partner say, I'm out.
Do you mean selling the group or selling if the partner wanted to sell out?
So if a partner want to sell out, it's written, the process would work, which is a multiple of EBITDA of the joint venture. Mm-hmm. If the groups want to buy, it's a higher multiple.
Okay.
For the same year.
So they're incentivized to sell it back to the group rather than...
They incentivize for waiting the group to want to buy back.
Okay.
Because you'd get a better multiple. Mm-hmm. So you should wait, which is clever. It has that financial implication I just explained. But it means that everything is done for, you know, until then, until you buy back, profit is 50-50. And the whole idea is that if you make a profit, you reinvest it to have another store and another store and another store. And the joint venture pay for the salary of the entrepreneur of the 50-50. So from day one, you get a salary, which is brilliant, because on the franchise business, from day one, you get zero. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So I think it's very interesting model. It has its negative, but from a growth standpoint and all that kind of stuff, it's pretty good.
You were with Tiger. How long did you stay with Tiger for?
I stayed for 2 years.
2 years. And obviously at some stage you got an itch to, well, I suppose, I won't put words in your mouth, but you wanted to come home. So there was a personal, or home, I say Dublin.
Yeah.
There was a personal side to things, but you had obviously wanted to start your own business and have something that was more under your control or something at that stage. How did Amarino and everything that you have now, how did that come about?
Yeah. The plan was to say, okay, well, Ireland is a small country. Having, you know, lived in London, Denmark, and being French, I saw that sometimes in Ireland you still offer products that are not as good as they could be, and simply because it's a smaller country. And you had had people that have had massive growth and good profit because they were early and maybe they just didn't have the competition and whatever, and they benefit from things. So I looked at different franchise concepts that I liked, and Amarino was one of them. So that's what I decided on. Different other things over the last few years, but certainly Amarino was one of them.
And it's really the high quality ice cream and gelato that it does. Like, it's not made with powder or anything like that.
No. It's a high-end ice cream. It has now 200 ice cream around the world, and it will be often, you know, tested as the best ice cream you can get. I think, you know, there's no artificial flavors or colorings. All our sorbet are vegan, and you just need to taste it. And you hear it from people coming. It's always a oh wow.
And you had obviously, you had had it in Europe somewhere in a store. Is that how you came across it? Or
I came across it in Los Angeles, also Las Vegas. And I was in Las Vegas. I was by myself there doing a study trip. Desperately, just wanted a shot of espresso, not the big long Americano. I didn't want Starbucks. And I found Amarino, which I kind of knew half of it or whatever. And they had a good, I think it's called the... It's not the strip or whatever. There's a road that is famous. Anyway, they just opened the Amarino. I sat down and I did some emails and I stayed for an hour and I looked at what they were doing and had customer and then by the time that hour was gone, I went from espresso to taste the ice cream and it was just awesome. And so I got in touch, understand what they were doing, come to the conclusion so that it would be good to try it here in Ireland.
How quickly did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I went to visit a few in France. I met a couple of franchisees, the master franchisee in the UK, and then I met the founder, and then we had a few conversations, and by the time we were in September, I think we agreed to move forward. So it took me 6 months to go from first experience to agree a deal, and then another 6 months to open the shop.
What is it that makes it special, or what is it that makes it?
Well, I think there's certainly, like, I mean, anybody that will taste the products on a comparable basis. So you won't have bubblegum ice cream, all right? And my kids will be the first one to, if they see a blue ice cream, will say, can I have the bubblegum or the bubblegum sauce, right? So you won't have that in Amarino. So I can't judge bubblegum ice cream, but anybody that will take any of the ice cream and compare it will have a much better taste. And the overall flavor and the overall quality, you know, it's not high C, it's just so the product's amazing. They also have macaron, which is frozen ice cream in the middle, which nobody else does. And we also have a sorbet chocolate that nobody else does. And it's absolutely delicious. So, and there's the last thing is the way you create the product. We call them the gelato artists because they put a flower together. So when you buy a cone, you don't have two lumps of ice cream. We're actually shaping the ice cream in flowers, which actually enable us to tell the customers you can have as many flavors as you want. So in most places, you know, they will sell you, oh, you want one flavor, is that price. You want the second flavor, is that price, because they're doing by scoop. So there's very little places that can do more than three flavors. Well, we most of the time, depends on the time of the year, but we have up to 22, 23 flavors. So if you want 23 flavors, I wouldn't recommend it, but we can put 23 flavors on the ice cream.
Because each petal of the flower is a different flavor, yeah. Or can be,
yeah,
if you want it.
Yeah, it can be, yeah.
And why ice cream? I mean, is there anything about ice cream in terms of the retail market? Or, like, you could have gone technically into any retail area because you'd been across pretty much the whole, every product you can imagine. Was there anything about ice cream in particular?
I like my food. So I had narrowed it down to let's do something about food first. I tried to get Leon, and Leon now is in Ireland because I think Leon has a good edge as well. But I think what's great about ice cream is that you can have a full experience. You can sit down and you don't have to, you know, for a family of four going to a restaurant, unless you go to McDonald's. If you go to a restaurant, you're going to have to spend 100 euros. You may spend 60 or 70, depends where you're going, but you may have to spend 100 euros. Here in Amorigno, you can actually sit down and have a great experience with kids. And if it's a family of four, you'll have plenty in your stomach for 20 euros, 25 euros. And the whole family will have had a good experience.
Is there anything, so you'd gone from kind of big corporates to now running what was essentially, you know, a much smaller business. What was the transition like for you? Have you enjoyed it? Do you prefer working much more on your own, or what are your thoughts on?
I think I would do it differently if I was doing it again. I think on entrepreneur, you can be quite lonely at the beginning. So yes, you take a franchise, so you talk with the franchisor, but the reason why a franchisor has a franchisee is that he's seeing you 5 or 6 times a year, and that's fine. I've always been pretty hands-on, so I like doing everything. So, you know, for me, it was super exciting to find the site, work with the architect and the builders, you know, do all the negotiation on prices, blah, blah, blah. It was interesting to meet you and you know, get the bookkeeping going and understanding in the system, because my objective always been to have a certain amount. On the business plan, I like to have 5 or 6. I could have maybe 10. I'll be happy with 2 or 3 in the next 2 or 3 years. The great thing that I really liked, and I'll do it again, is really be in charge of everything, from finding the property to setting up the IT system to doing the bookkeeping with yourself and so on and so forth. What's then happened is that because the Irish environment is not actually necessarily the easiest to get cash, you are slower, unless you're happy to throw, you know, €1 million on the table and open 3 or 4 stores, it's going to be slow. So I think for me, the speed has been much lower than I would have wanted to be. And it turns out it's great because I've done a huge amount of learning in terms of, and I know the next store, I know exactly what I want, where I want it, how the architect designed it, and all that kind of stuff. So in some ways, I've always been growing fast, fast, fast. You know, in Tiger, I opened like 200 stores a year. So I came here and said, well, I'll open 3 stores in 3 years. It will be 3 years in March next year, and we have 1 store. And in our side, with COVID-19 and all the rest, and also the learning, really going into the details, it's good that we've been slow.
There's a difference between wanting to grow quickly, but there's a lot of people, especially in recent times in Ireland, who would grow quickly at any cost. Mm-hmm. And not really looking at that. But you necessarily didn't get caught up in that, or just wanting to grow quickly for the sake of it.
I think I was lucky that I didn't cut up in it, because if property, the right property, would have been available at the right price, I would absolutely have grown faster. That the property was not there because if it was there, people would overbid me.
It was being cautious, like when people were overbidding you for properties and things like that. It could have been easy to get competitive and just to outbid people, but, you know, sacrificing maybe profit or something in the long run.
Yeah, and in my view, and you're doing my bookkeeping, so you're seeing it. In my view, you know, business in Ireland, especially in the hospitality, profit is not high enough to enable people to give the right quality and the right service to customers. And that's linked to VAT, it's linked to rents, and it's linked to rent. The landlord government need to enable retailers, and not necessarily the chain like Amorino, but like there's loads of people that would be quite happy to just have a little coffee shop to make good living. it's hard work. It's 24/7. You know, a few times, once we had problem with the freezer. I'll tell you what, like when you arrive and you have to put everything in the bin because the freezer is at -2 instead of being at -20, it's tough. And sometimes the staff doesn't turn up or the staff has forgotten their key and you're the only one with the extra key. It's Sunday lunch and you have all your family over. What do you do? And so I think, you know, this is the kind of work that I think should be more rewarding so that people are keen to go in. And I think that's something that needs to change in terms of...
The pandemic might help that along?
Unfortunately, I think the pandemic will help with the rent because there'll be more availability. There's also a society thing. So you could say that, well, the pandemic may have opened the door to even more online. I think those things will take time. I think over the next couple of years, we'll see how it goes. But I do think that a big, big part is landlord and retailer working better together. And I think government can facilitate that.
What are your goals in the near to medium term?
Well, there's two locations I'd like to get, and maybe I'll get them. So that will be my medium term in terms of location. Now, I do think we can do more at servicing directly our ice cream to customers. So Deliveroo is an enabler. I just need to find the right locations and the right partner to do it with. And that's my kind of very short term.
Because there's a lot more, excuse the pun, moving parts when it comes to delivering ice cream versus delivering something else. It's much easier to keep something hot than it is to keep something cold or at the right temperature.
Well, not necessarily to the extent that, I don't know if you ever had, but half hot pizza is not very good. The reality is that with the ice cream and the packaging that we have, you can keep a high quality ice cream and temperature for half an hour. A hot pizza that traveled in a carton box, in my view, is not hot enough. Yeah, it's just finding the, in terms of the last mile, well, or the last 3 kilometers, but it's just getting the right process with the supply and the forecast and the location. Because having a freezer and somebody standing at a freezer to take it out of the freezer to give it to a delivery driver would be a bit costly if you don't get the right volume quickly.
Is there one thing you've learned from the whole experience of setting up Amarino here in Dublin?
Yeah, I mean, there's one thing. I had quite a lot of experience and I knew quite a bit. I was confident, but not in a cocky way. But I think if I was doing it again, I would look at taking a partner. It's not from the need wouldn't be from a financial standpoint. It's more for be able to bounce back idea and you're not always right. And whoever you are, you need to have to be able to step back and being able to have the right conversation. And certainly my great desire of going on my own was to be my own boss and my own shareholders. So that's why I said no partner. In hindsight, I think a partner helps you staying sane and having the right conversation. So I would recommend entrepreneur to find a buddy. It doesn't have to necessarily be a financially incentivized buddy, but finding somebody that you can actually go on that journey together.
Is there anything you've really learned and taken with you, either in recent years or that you learned earlier on that you always remember and that you keep with you?
I think the importance of people. You can have the best products and the best idea. The people that are managing that ideas or managing that product or giving that product to customers is not right. You know, if my guys, when they serve the ice cream, they're crying, that's not going to be a good experience. So I do think the importance of people is, you know, it's quite typical or an easy answer, but it's hard to get right.
Great. Xavier Vidal, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me again.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.